Okay, good evening, everybody. Thank you all for coming. Just to give you a word of background to what we're trying to accomplish tonight. In my mind, Purim is a very unique holiday, and I'm not going to speak about this extensively now, but just one or two quick points. Number one, as I think Rav Ben Zev may be speaking about later, we know that Purim involves hachana. Purim involves a little bit of preparation. Because according to Chazal, Purim is one of the holidays that involves Kabbalas HaTorah, accepting the Torah. On Purim, Chazal say that the Jews re-accepted the Torah out of voluntary will. It was a time that the Jews, out of their own free will, went back, and even though, according to the Gemara, they may have been forced at Kabbalas HaTorah to accept it in some form, that form is not clear, but whatever form it was, the Gemara says that they re-accepted it again in the days of Achashverosh after the miracle of the Purim story. So many of the Sifrei Machshava look at Purim as a holiday of Kabbalas HaTorah, not only Torah Shebichtav, but really mainly Torah Shebaal Peh. And therefore we know that to accept the Torah, you need to have Hachana, you need to have some sort of preparation. So in that vein, I think preparation for Purim in this form of Kabbalas HaTorah is very, very important, and that's part of the reason why it's important to have some sort of Torah preparation, Leil Yun, for the upcoming holiday. As I mentioned a few times on the postings, so there's a famous poster that goes up every year in YU, which I think originally came from Rav David Lifshitz. He has a whole paragraph there. I don't even remember the rest of the paragraph. But it starts out that Mishinichas Adar Marben B'Simcha, as we all know, and then he continues the Ain't Simcha Ela B'Torah, which is a quote from some earlier Sfarim, that Simcha is only through Torah. And then he says that around Adar time you should be mechazik yourself and you should establish more times to learn Torah, more Sidrei Limud if you're in yeshiva, or let's say out of yeshiva it would be, you know, allowing yourself more opportunities to be able to sit down and learn. And Kol Amarav HaRizim Meshubach, he's got a whole paragraph there, very, very nice. But that's, again, part of the idea for this Leil Yun. Point number two, many of the Sifrei Chassidus and Sifrei Kabbalah, the Baal Shem Tov discusses this, it's mentioned also in the Nesi Oshalom and many, many other places. It's well known in the Olam HaChassidus that Purim is also a unique holiday in that Kol HaPoshed Yad Nosnim Lo. This is a paraphrase from the Gemara, which is quoted by Halacha on the Shulchan Aruch, that on Purim, anybody that stretches out their hand, we give him. Meaning, for the rest of the year, for Hilchos Tzedakah, we usually have to ask people whether they're, find out exactly what their story is. If they ask you for Tzedakah, you have to investigate. You can give, but you really, if you want to give a lot of money, you're really supposed to find out first exactly what their story is. On Purim, though, the rules don't apply. On Purim, anybody that asks, we give him. That's the rule, and you find in many places, especially in Israel, that's what happens. These people come to your door, call a poshet yad, give me something. You know, you'll see it if you haven't seen it here. Certainly in your shalayim, it happens all the time. What'd you say? Start tonight. Baruch Hashem, early Purim. Purim starts a week early. For some people, Purim is all year round. But the Sifrei Chassidus, what they do is they say the same thing, the same way that we judge other people in Olam Hazeh, in this world, so too Hashem judges us in Shemayim. And if we give to anybody on Purim, so too anybody that makes a request of a Kadosh Baruch Hu on Purim will also be answered. Anybody that's Poshet Yad, that asks in the Olam HaTfilos, in terms of requests and other things, Hashem will answer in some form. So this, and there are many, many stories that, you know, that show that this has taken place in with Hasidic rebbes that were, you know, that the people came with, they had problems, they couldn't have children, they had this, and on Purim was the day the rebbe said to come and, you know, and give Hashem some sort of spiritual sacrifice, make some sort of major commitment, and you know, Hashem will grant you Yeshuas with a little bit of tefillah. That's another important idea of Purim in that realm. And I think for that also, that requires preparation. It requires a little bit of involvement beforehand in some of the ideas of Purim, some of the Torah of Purim, and some of the machshavas. Again, the hachana, the preparation that we have here, hopefully should be viewed in that realm as well, so that we can use some of our spiritual gains to ask Hashem for things that we need on Purim. In many places in the world, it's become a custom that people daven vasika now on Purim. I think in Lakewood this became very, very big recently. You're sleeping already? but that idea that Purim is not only a day to become drunk and be crazy and totally, you know, running all over the place and not know what you're doing with yourself, this model serves as an alternate to that, which is basically that you're taking the day of Purim very, very seriously because the amount of spiritual power that you have on Purim is much greater than any other day. And the third point on the other side is exactly the opposite. That's the idea of drinking, which hopefully Rav Daniel Reifman will speak about a little bit. According to many that feel that the mitzvah of drinking on Purim is literal and that you should totally, totally get drunk, this is discussed by the Maharal and others that take the extreme approach saying that you must drink and get drunk.
Spiced.
Same idea. What'd you say?
Spiced.
Levesume. Okay, did you get that in the Torah once? Maybe. I think you might have been drunk also when you said that. Okay. Whatever. No. Just kidding. But the idea, according to that also, is that the nichnas yayin yatzah so, that on Purim the real you comes out. If you're really drinking on Purim, drinking is a test. The test is, have you prepared yourself properly before Purim? And the answer is discovered if you drink, when you drink. When you drink, the real you comes out. How do you figure out what the real you is? That's decided by what comes out when you are inebriated, when you can't control yourself. If the real you that comes out is flowing with Torah and Kedusha and Kabbalah and who knows what else, Halacha, whatever it is, different Torah spewing, a holy person, if that's who you really are inside, it's going to come out on Purim when you drink. And if you're not, God forbid, then the other side is going to come out. So drinking, according to this approach, is a test. And according to this approach also, the test has to be, needs preparation, need hachana before Purim. I think in the light of these three factors, I think we can begin our learning for tonight, and hopefully it should serve us in many, many different ways for our hachanas for Purim. And we should be able to grow on many levels. Okay. So I'm going to start. We'll have about 20-25 minutes or so learning a little bit about one approach to Megillas Esther, and the Rav Daniel Reifman will give the second shiur after a few minute break, and then Rav Shlomo Ben Zev, God willing, will give the last shiur. If you have a Megillah, so it's worthwhile to try to follow along. We're not going to be looking at every pasuk, one after the other, but just to be able to follow some of the ideas. If you know the Megillah well, hopefully you won't need it, and otherwise you can listen carefully and hopefully can get the gist of things. This approach is actually mainly taken from one of my teachers in Yeshiva University, one of my Tanakh teachers, the Rabbi Chaim Angel, an excellent, excellent teacher, and he actually has an article about this in a book that he wrote called Through an Opaque Lens. I have it at home. It was originally printed in a different place. I think it was in Tradition. I don't remember exactly where he printed it originally. Yeah, it was in Tradition 2000. It's also based on another Hebrew sefer called Hadassah Hi Esther, which you may have seen. I have it at home as well. It was written by Rabbanim in the Yeshivat Haratzion, the Gush Yeshiva community. And they basically took a bunch of different perspectives and looked at some of the Pshat and Drash issues in Megillas Esther. And this is one approach which comes out from some of the writers in that sefer, as well as Rabbi Angel. Question that you might ask when you start reading through the Megillah is, why did this happen to the Bnei Yisrael? Meaning, what did they do wrong to deserve the potential destruction that we see through the Megillah, for which, of course, we are saved on Purim? That's why we celebrate Purim. But there has to be a reason why the whole thing started in the first place. And that's what you wonder when you begin to read the Megillah and you see that Haman comes to the king and the king says, yes, I'll do whatever you say. Haman thinks the Jewish people should be destroyed. The Jewish people start fasting. What happens? So this is actually a very difficult question. The Gemara and Megillah discusses this, but the truth is that there's no clear answer from the Gemara in Megillah. The Gemara begins by asking what exactly the problem was. Why did they merit this potential destruction? And the what we say, the Gemara says as follows. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai was the one who tried to answer the question. So he told them, "You answer first. Yeah, you start." So they answer. This is the answer that everybody knows, because Mibesha Nehanu Misudas Achashverosh. They enjoyed. They took benefit from the feast of Achashverosh. So Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, he said to them, "Well, if that's true, then in Shushan they should have been killed, because that's where the people came to enjoy the feast of Achashverosh. But the people in the other areas of Achashverosh's kingdom who did not come, they shouldn't be chayev. They shouldn't be destroyed. So why were they also subject to the decree of Haman?"
So they said, well,
then you answer the question. So he answered, they bowed down to the image. What's the image? So there's actually two opinions about what the image was. Either the image was Haman had some sort of image Avodah Zarah with him. That's one approach. Rashi mentions something along those lines in the Gemara. The other approach mentioned by other Rishonim is that it was the image with Nebuchadnezzar, meaning Nebuchadnezzar much earlier, the previous generation, made others in Bnei Yisrael bow down to an image. And that's why the Jewish people now are being threatened with destruction. So the question they asked him, well, if that's true, then why did Hashem forgive them? Meaning, why were they saved? They should have really been destroyed. So the answer is that they only pretended to worship, and therefore Hashem also only pretended to exterminate them. And that's, they quote a few psukim to support that. So the whole thing is a little bit strange. The first answer that he gives about being enjoying Achashverosh's party, very, very strange, number one, because of what the Gemara says, and number two, there are other midrashim which say that the Jews specifically avoided the party. Rabbi Angel quotes from the Midrash Padam Acherim and other midrashim in the Torah Shlema that the Jews actually specifically stayed away, or they actually cried and mourned over Achashverosh's party. So that's very, very strange. According to the second approach of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, they bowed down to the image. So, number one, if it was an image, if it was the Tzelem in the times of Nebuchadnezzar, that was before their time. Why should their generation be potentially destroyed for something that happened before their time? That's question number one. Number two, it's also strange. The Megillah never says any such thing. If you look in the Megillah, every time in the Megillah where the Jews are mentioned, primarily in Perek Dalet, but certainly later in Parachet and Tet, if you skip through the Megillah quickly, you see do the Jews ever do anything wrong in the actual Megillah? It never says that they did. They're fasting, they're listening to what Mordechai tells them. Later they are, they're fighting, they're celebrating, they're doing kindness with their friends, Mishloach Manot, Matanot Le'Avyonim. We never find anywhere in the Pshat of the Megillah that the Jews are condemned for doing anything wrong. And second to that, if you contrast the Megillah with other Sfarim and Tanakh, it's startling. Other Sfarim in Tanakh, in Nevi'im, mainly in Nevi'im, what are all the Nevi'im talking about? They're all about the prophets casticizing the Jewish people and rebuking them for not being close to God, not doing the mitzvos, not having the proper intentions, to not be acting appropriately with their friends. It's all about God says to the Navi, go to the people and tell them that you're doing the wrong thing, and if you don't shape up soon, I'm going to destroy you. Over and over and over again, every single prophet that deals with the connection between Am Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's what you see. You see the Jewish people are not doing the right thing, and they're taken to task for it. Come to the Megillah, and it's totally missing. Hashem is missing. The people doing something wrong is missing. And this whole idea of this connection of that the Jews are supposed to be destroyed because something is not right is missing from the Megillah. Where did it go? What's going on here? So this is the approach that Rabbi Angel and some of the authors in the book want to suggest. Again, there are many, many different approaches to answer this question. Again, I'm just suggesting one approach right now. And the way it begins is by looking at the main character in the Megillah. And the question is, who exactly is the main character in the Megillah? You can throw out some names. Maybe it's Esther, maybe it's Haman, maybe it's Mordechai. Oh, so it's very, very interesting. If you look at the Megillah, how does the Megillah begin? The whole Perek Aleph of the Megillah, what is it all about? It's always how we look at a sefer by the way that it's introduced. The whole Perek Aleph, what are we talking about here? How is this related to the plot of the Purim story? And the answer is, I have no idea. Again, you can give suggestions. Some people talk about how Vashti, the point of Perek Aleph is that Vashti was the queen and we have to know how she was deposed and how she was killed in order to make way for Esther and to see the underneath the surface how Esther is put into the picture. It all has to do with the Su'udah and with how Vashti was treated and how she refused, etc., etc., which is a good answer. The problem is that the whole first part before that, we have an elaborate description, many, many psukim about Achashverosh and about Achashverosh's wealth, his palace, his Su'udah, his feast. It's crazy. Look at it. It says, if you look at Pesukim Gimel Dalet, Hey Vav Zayin and Chet, it says, Baharato et Osher Kavod Malchuto, how much wealth he had, Yikar Tiferet Kudulato, his glory. He had this feast for 180 days. He had Chur Karpas with Techelet Achuz B'Chavlevutz V'Argaman, all these different kinds of things these different types of materials, hashkot bechlei zahav, v'chelim mekelim shonim, golden utensils, plenty of wine and drinking, of course. How could you have the Megillah without drinking? It's elaborate. What is this all doing here? Why do you need such an expanded description of these details that's not really relevant to the rest of the plot? Okay, that's number one. Number two, if you look at, and many people discuss the conflict between Haman and Mordechai. Those are the two people that are facing off in the Megillah. Esther obviously is also involved. But Haman and Mordechai are the two protagonists, we'll call them. But the problem is, if you look at the Megillah, it doesn't seem that they themselves are dependent on themselves in order to make whatever they want to happen. What happens? If you go to Perek Bet, of course, everything that's happening is based on Achashverosh. Achashverosh remembers that he killed Vashti. Achashverosh looks for a queen. Perek Gimel, if you look through Achar Advarim Ha'ilah, how does Haman get into position? Gidal HaMelech Achashverosh. That's Haman. It's Achashverosh who's pulling the strings. What happens? Haman is the one who obviously doesn't like the fact that Mordechai is not bowing down to him. But on his own, he can't really do very much. He has to go to Achashverosh and say, you know what, Mr. King? There are a lot of people that I think are not behaving themselves properly, that are not doing what the king wants in their kingdom. Please let me destroy them. And Vayasar and Pasuk Yud, Perakim and Pasuk Yud, Vayasar HaMelech HaTabato, the king gives his ring to Haman. Again, is it Haman himself? No, it's Haman only based on Achashverosh. And the whole rest of the paragimel, if you look at it, you find that the scribes or the kings are the ones that are writing down everything that's happening, and that they should be sent out the decree to all the places in the kingdom to destroy the Jews. And b'shemach hamelach Achashverosh nichtav v'nechtam b'tabat hamelach and pasuk yud bet. It's written in the name of King Achashverosh, and it's signed with his signet ring. Everything is from Achashverosh, and you wonder what's going on here. Maybe Haman and Mordechai are not really the main characters in the Megillah. If you move through the rest of the Megillah, obviously when Esther comes to the king, she's very scared. She says, I can't come, I haven't come in 30 days. Achashverosh could kill me, right? You keep going. And the rest of the Megillah, everything depends on Achashverosh. When Esther finally discloses that Haman is the one who's trying to destroy the Jewish people, Achashverosh, of course, is the one that has to say, who is he, right? Oh, get rid of him, go hang him. It's all based on Achashverosh. And even after that, even after Achashverosh places Mordechai in charge of Haman's estate. This is the beginning of Perek Chet. So then what happens next? Is it finished? Is the story over? No. After that, Esther has to come. This is Perek Chet Pasuk Gimel. Vatosef Esther vatzdaber lifnei ha-melech. She has to come back to the king. Vatzipol lifnei raglav. She has to bow down to him. And then vatzivk vatzishanei lo. She has to cry out her heart to ask Achashverosh to remove the evil of Haman. Well, 1 second. What's going on here? Haman is dead. But no, the idea is that Achashverosh is still the one in charge, and she has to plead with him to make sure that he allows her to do what's necessary in order for the Jews to defend themselves. Again, everything's based on Achashverosh. And I think the icing on the cake, and this Angel and one of the other authors in the book, David Henschke, also point out, what's the end of the Megillah? What's the conclusion? Is the conclusion that we celebrate Purim happily ever after?
Texas.
So Perek Yud, right? Here we go. The very end of the Megillah in Perek Yud. How does it conclude? Vayosam HaMelech Achashverosh Masal Ha'aretz, right? That Achashverosh placed a tax on all of the lands. V'chol Masei Tokvo Gvuraso, all of the actions of Tokvo Gvuraso, of his Tokef, his control and his power, and Parashas Gedulas Mordechai, how Mordechai became great. How did he become great? Asher Gilo HaMelech, that the king made him great. They're all mentioned in the Sefer Dvar HaYamim, in the Book of Chronicles, Malchei Madaya Faras, or the kings of Madaya Faras. This, of course, if you know, in many, many places, when you read Vayasam HaMelech Achashverosh Mas, this is the last time, what does everybody do? Everybody boos, right? Even though it's not Haman, you suddenly hear a big chorus of boos for the taxes. But there's something to it, okay? We know what we're doing right out there. Everybody boos for this. Achashverosh is still the one in charge at the end of the day in the Megillah. What'd you say?
Noham.
Excellent. And that's what the Gemara says as well, that one of the reasons why we don't say Hal on Purim, even though one would think that we should, one of the reasons is because Akati Avdi Achashverosh, and we're still the servants of Achashverosh. He's still the one in charge at the end of the day. So we see that the world of Achashverosh is the world of the Megillah. That's what we're dealing with in the Megillah. And it's a very, very scary world because it, as the protagonists and antagonists in the Megillah know, Haman and Mordechai and Esther know very, very well that at the whim of thought, Achashverosh could change his mind. Things could change within 1 second from one direction to destroying the Jews to the other direction, Haman getting killed and the Jews being saved. You never know what Achashverosh is going to think. Say again?
I always got the impression that Haman like, thought he was in control. Like, I thought that,
so that depends on how you learn. Some people may say that. According to this approach, Haman knew full well what he was, who was in charge. However, we'll get to this in a second.
Okay,
you know, Haman tried to manipulate the king. That's the second part, which we'll get to right now. But in terms of who's really in, who's the one that's pulling the strings, it's clear that Achashverosh is the one that's pulling the strings. Now, even more than that, it's very, very interesting that that I think according to what we're saying here, and this is how Rabbi Angel discusses it, who takes the place of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Megillah? The answer is Achashverosh. Achashverosh is the one that really takes over the role of God and every other sefer of Tanakh. Here, HaMelech, again, the Gemara says HaMelech, sometimes refers to Hashem, but in the Pshat of the Megillah, it's Achashverosh. Everywhere, HaMelech, this, HaMelech, Achashverosh, that. He's the one in charge. He's the one that sort of usurps the role of God. And you look at some of the descriptions in Perak Aleph, it's very, very similar to some of the materials that are used in the Beis HaMikdash. And if you look in Perak Hay, where it says that Esther was not called for 30 days to come, and you look at the description of how it says how she has to go into the Chatzer HaPnimit, the inner sanctum of the king, the inner courtyard. What does that remind you of? The Kodesh HaKadoshim. Very good. Again, we have a parallel between Achashverosh and his palace and Hashem and the Beis HaMikdash. But yet Hashem is not here. Achashverosh has taken control. Very, very scary. Why is it especially scary? Because Achashverosh is human. And not only is he human, he is quite fickle. Okay, you never know what he's going to do, and he seems even a bit foolish. This is also a discussion in the Gemara. He's the one that promotes Haman. At the same time, he, without even asking who Haman's talking about, he says, okay, Haman, you can go destroy the Jewish people. Okay, but then afterwards, when Esther comes to him and says, you know what, there's somebody who's trying to destroy the Jewish people, he says, me, who's Eliezer? Well, who is he? I don't know who he is. Who are you talking about? Hello, where have you been? Achashverosh, it's all your fault. You did this. Okay, very, very strange. After Haman is destroyed, after he's dead, so Esther pleads with Haman, let's come and try to save the Jewish people. So in Parachet, when she says, please let's remove the svarim of Machashevet Haman ben Hamdat, and this is Parachet Pasuk Hay and Vav. So she says, let's remove all the letters that say that we should be able to for the kingdom to destroy us. What does Achashver say? Well, you know what? You know, you can defend yourselves, but I can't go back on the decree of the king. Meaning, once I gave the decree, it's finished. What's going on here? A king sent out a decree, he can't take it back? He can't repeal it? It's ridiculous. Very, very strange. So you see that Achashverosh, even though he's all-powerful, at the same time, he's not so in control of what he's doing. For goodness sakes, his own wife, Vashti, refuses to listen to him. He can't even get her to listen to him. How is he supposed to get everybody else to listen to him? So the Jews are stuck, and this is the real problem here. How do you deal with a ruler who is all-powerful in the Megillah, but at the same time, you have no idea what he's going to do? There's no way to know which direction he's going to go.
He saved his life.
Second?
He saved his life.
Ah,
Mordechai
so
saved his life.
Also, Mordechai saved his life, but at the end of the day, it didn't help right away. Achashverosh forgot about it. Right? Later, he comes back and parades him through the streets.
Yeah, I guess he made a...
Oh, so Rabbi Angel also, they also point out...
If Achashverosh would have been... If Big Son of Rish and Sarish were successful, I guess Mordechai was thinking, that there would be more trouble. Esther would be in more trouble. He was already married to Achashverosh, and he'd be dead.
But the problem is that, again, Achashverosh didn't respond.
Like status quo.
Right, it's true, but Achashverosh didn't respond to what Mordechai did. He didn't, at the time, at the end of the Perek Bet, he doesn't do anything about it. Instead, who does he promote? He promotes Haman. Okay, so again, it's the same. It's true that you would think that that would help, and obviously at the end of the day, it somewhat does. But even after Achashverosh tells Haman to parade Mordechai around the streets because of the fact that he saved the king's life from Bigtan and Teresh, at the end of Perek Vav, you still see what does Mordechai do at the end of Perek Vav? Exactly, he goes right back to his sackcloth and ashes. This is at the in Perek Vav. Pasuk Yud Bet. Vayasha Mordechai al Shara Melech Vahaman Id Chaf al Beto Avel Vachafui Rosh. Okay, so Haman goes back to his to the Shara HaMelech, and what they assume, the Chazal assume here is that he's going back to his sackcloth and ashes, meaning he's not he's not done yet. I mean, he realizes that nothing has changed, and still, even though he's been, you know, promoted by the king, not really promoted, but he's been paraded around, that doesn't necessarily help. He's still at the king's mercy to decide what's going to happen with the Jewish people. So what do Bnei Israel do? How do you respond to such a difficult, difficult, treacherous world? So the answer is, if you look at the Megillah, what the Bnei Israel do is they're always doing the right thing. They're listening to Mordechai. They're fasting. They're trying to get out of what's happening. At the end of the Megillah, they are fighting. They don't, it says many, many times in Parak Tevu, Vavizel lo shalchu yadam, they didn't take any of the spoils. They didn't go too far. They give Mishloach Manot, Matanot le'Avyonim. Everything is doing consistently portrayed in a very, very positive light. So from this perspective, what the Jews are doing is realizing that they know that Hashem is in charge. Okay, they know Hashem is in charge. They may not always know why everything is happening. And this, at the end of the day, is the answer to the original question that we started with. Do the Jews know why they're threatened with destruction? Not necessarily. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But even in Chazal, they're conflicted about what's going on here, why they were... why Haman chose to destroy them. And certainly in the text of the Megillah, we don't see any reference to them doing anything wrong. So according to this approach, the answer is that they did not necessarily know why things were happening to them. And this is a very, very difficult situation.
Mordechai also did?
According to this approach, the answer would be no. According to other approaches, the answer might be yes. But according to the approach we're developing right now, the answer would be that he did not necessarily know what was happening. Okay, you don't see in the Megillah that he knew. He doesn't tell people, do tshuva because you sinned, because you ate treif. Yeah, and some midrashim say that, but according to this approach, you know, that's not necessarily the case.
Maybe the point that up until now, this is the beginning of the time where there's no Nevi'im anymore.
Oh, exactly.
While they're in Nevi'im, the Nevi'im right. Tell you what you did wrong.
Oh,
since then,
beautiful.
Every single bad thing has happened since then, we don't know.
Exactly. So that's basically what Rabbi Angel is pushing here, and that's what I'm suggesting as well. That the idea here is that they did not necessarily know what was wrong, but this is where you exercise your bitachon and your amunah, your faith in God, that even though things are very, very difficult and you seem to be at the whim of a human king that you have no idea what he's going to be doing the next minute, at the same time you must put your full trust in a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And you have to know that at the end of the day, Hashem will pull the strings to make sure that things go the way that they are supposed to. And that's how the Jews hopefully saw the hand of God through the whole story here, meaning they saw beneath the surface to realize that even though Ahasuerus seems to be all-powerful, at the end of the day, he's not really the one that is making sure that the Jews get saved. I think that this is the idea of Megillas Esther, and this is why Megillas Esther, according to this approach, serves as a message and really a model for us today in Gullus, much more so than many of the other books in Tanakh. Meaning the other books in Tanakh, as we mentioned, as Yaakov mentioned also, have all of these themes of the prophets, the Nevi'im, coming to you and telling you exactly what you did wrong. Today, we don't always know what we did wrong. We have to guess. And the Megillah also, they didn't necessarily know, but at the same time, the point, the response is, and this is what Rav Soloveitchik used to emphasize as well, many times when tragedy strikes, as unfortunately we've seen in the last couple days as well, is that we don't have to know every time what we did wrong, but we need to do tshuva, we need to search and do introspect, and think on our own without the help of Nevi'im, how can we improve ourselves, what can we do better? And it's tough in Gullus. We don't, even when we're in Eretz Yisrael, we don't always know why things are happening. We have to do our best to try to have emunah, to have faith that everything that's happening is for a purpose. And even if Hashem is not outwardly pulling the strings, we have to know that at the end of the day, inwardly, beneath the surface, he is pulling the strings. And in the Megillah, even though the conclusion of the Megillah is that Ahasuerus is still in charge, he's still the one who is making the taxes, he's still the one who is creating a situation that we can't say halal because we're still servants of his, but we've seen a glimpse of what Hashem can do in the world. That's what we see in the Megillah. We see from beneath the surface that Hashem has the power to make salvation happen. And that's how we know we can take that comfort and say that today also we see bits and pieces, certainly here in Eretz Yisrael in the last 50 years, Medina Yisrael, we've seen more than bits and pieces of how Hashem runs the world. And we have to hope that one day, hopefully very, very soon, we'll see the rest of the picture as well. We can be confident that at the end of days, Hashem will reveal himself and show us exactly why everything happens and that he's the one in charge, making sure that everybody will recognize his power in the times of Mashiach. So to conclude, I think that that this stage of Jewish history, after Hester Panim, after the time when God is concealed, we look to the Megillah and to Mordechai and the Jews here for inspiration, and to Hashem in the Megillah, who is right beneath the surface. And the same way that Ahasuerus is the one in charge, we say Psukim and Tehillim and other elsewhere say that you should always you never want to be in the hands of humans. Okay. There's a pasuk, I forgot exactly where it is, until, and we say it every day, one of the halakhukas, that al tiftachu min divim, veredam shelo tishua. You should never put your faith in divim, and the big, you know, the princes and the main people in charge, people that don't have any salvation. Many other pasukim also that illustrate this point. We don't want to put ourselves, we never want to see ourselves in the hands of others. We have to realize that Hashem is always the one in charge, and even if they seem to be the ones that are pulling the strings, we have to have the faith that at the end of the day, good will triumph and Hashem will allow us to come out on top. Should all take this message into our Purims and recognize the true nature of the Megillah and the nature of Hashem's salvation beneath the surface, and be able to elevate our Amunah in trying times to greater and greater levels. Okay, take a couple minute break, and hopefully in a few minutes, Rav Daniel Reichman will speak about drinking on Purim.
So what's the last
So the shiur is on the topic of drinking on Purim, but slightly broader perspective than a standard shiur that we just focus on the halacha. I did not bring props, unfortunately. So starting with the Gemara. You see here on the source sheet, Yehud Gemara, Megillah, and Zion, and Medbet. Amar Rav Mechayev Inish LeBesumi B'Puria Adzalo Yada Bein Aror Haman LeBarach Mordechai. A person has to get drunk on Purim until Rava says, a person has to get drunk on Purim until he doesn't know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. Rav Rabbi Zera Avdu Sudas Purim B'Hadi Hadadei. Rav and Rabbi Zera made Purim Suda together. Yibshin, they got drunk. Kam Rabba Shachte the Rabbi Zera. Rabba got up and killed Rabbi Zera. V'machar by Rachme v'achye. The next day, Rabba prayed, and Rabbi Zera was miraculously revived. Lishana, the next year, Amar le'nesi marv navitzu das purim b'hadi adah. The next year, he said to him, we have a tradition, let's do purim shiz together again. Amar le'i lo b'chol shata b'shata mitrachish nisa. Not every day, or not every time, can we rely on a miracle. So, I assume some of you are familiar with this Gemara? Yes. So, before I go launch into it, let me get your thoughts.
That's quite amusing.
It's a pretty humorous Gemara. Somebody told me about somebody writing their thesis on humor in the Gemara. I thought, okay, well, here's one. I can think of really only one other example of blatant self-conscious humor in Shas, but... the Gemara Masechim on Yud Mitbet, is it? No, Ten Mitbet. Yeah, the Chulda. Okay. Anyway, for those familiar, the Gemara did like a whole Ed McMahon setup, and then there's like the punchline. Anyway, this is certainly a can be seen as a humorous story. Any other thoughts? Does the Gemara strike you as normal? Is this what the Gemara normally does?
The CPR in the Gemara. We have Elisha, we have this.
One of the examples of things that we just forgot how to do.
Well, it seems to be a bit dangerous to take the advice of getting drunk and purring.
Okay, it does seem to be dangerous.
There could be some unanticipated consequences.
Okay, so. Really what we're starting to get at is, why is the story here? What's the story doing? The Gemara's job is not to tell us stories, or so we think. The Gemara's job is to tell us what the halacha is, and that's what Rebbe does. And there's this story that suggests that somehow the halacha may not be so good for your health. Is that something that normally happens in the Gemara?
Masa lista.
Okay, once you start thinking about this phenomenon, which is very, very, really blatantly set out in this Gemara, there's a tension between the halacha and the story that follows. Once you start thinking about it, you realize this kind of thing happens all the time. It happens, I wouldn't say every time there's a maisa in a Tanaitic source, but a lot of the time when there's the Mishnah or Braita gives a halacha, and then there's a maisa. More often than not, the Maaseh does something to kind of make you question the halacha or undermine a certain point in the halacha. Sometimes it's actually subversive, in which case the Gemara says, Maaseh listor, Did the Mishnah or Braita bring a masa to undermine the halacha? What would be the point of that?
It usually comes to bring out to kind of focus the halacha.
The Gemara always comes up with an answer, right? Whenever it says masa lister, there's always an answer, right? No, that's what's typically the answer.
That was in that situation.
That was just to draw out a particular point in the halacha. That was an exception. That was an unusual circumstance. Yes, there's always an answer, right? We never end up saying yes. The ma'as is there to undermine the halacha, right? There's always an exception, right? The ma'asa is always somehow carves out a space within the halacha that the halacha doesn't apply to, at least in the way that we thought. This is unusual, not only because it's so blatant, but because if the Gemara were to continue here, if we were to continue the Gemara, say, Masa this door, well, what would you say? That was an exception? Why was that an exception?
Could we say as a warning, you should drink, but not to excess?
We have to come up with some way, right? When we look at this Gemara, we have to come up with some way to try to put the halacha and the story together in a way that makes them not contradict, right? We can't do what the Gemara usually does, which is find some sort of safe space to put the masa in and leave the rest of the halacha mostly intact, right? We can't do that here because the story seems to completely undermine the halacha. It's completely subversive. You could say, don't get drunk when you have dangerous weapons in your hands, and that's what Rab... Right? You could say something like that, but nothing. There's no obvious way to limit the scope of the halacha in a way that leaves room for the masa and not to violate the halacha.
Maybe on the contrary, maybe the masa is coming to show high vision of the sunnah on Purim to such an extent that something like this could happen. I mean, they actually might be proving it.
That you have to get so drunk, right? This might be proving that you have to get so drunk that you're capable of slaughtering somebody at your breakfast. It's certainly possible.
For those of us who can't revive the dead, we have to be careful.
Right, you could have said that the mice applies only to those people who are chayiv of doing or capable of doing tchias amazing. It's possible, right? Let's focus a little more on the story, because the story is a subversive story, but I think there's more to it than merely subversive, and I think this gets to the point that you're making, right? That maybe you do have to get drunk every single Purim until the point where you could potentially slaughter somebody at your table. What else in the story? What other aspects of the story suggest a possible either resolve the tension or deepen the tension between the story and the halacha? Because it doesn't end there, right? If the point of the story were to say you have to get drunk until you're capable of slaughtering somebody at your table, where would the story end? He killed him, okay, finished, done, sorry, I was just being kind to halacha. An observant life has its costs, and this is one of them. Occasionally you lose a guest or two. What happens afterwards? He comes back to life, right? And then there's a continuation. He tries again next year, right? And Rabbi Zair says, well, if this is how you're poskening, I'm going to find someplace else. Lo b'shol cholshata v'shata mitrachish nisa, right? What does that say, essentially? That was an exception. What happened last year was an exception. We cannot make a rule out of it. When we think about the conflict between halacha and agada, or more broadly, law and narrative, for those who have heard me talk about this topic in one of its many guises that I have talked about it in the past and will continue to talk about it as long as I'm writing my thesis on it. When we think about law and narrative, right, one of the distinctive features, maybe the distinctive feature of narrative, is that it is exceptional, right? Is that it's unusual. Why do we read stories? Why do we read narratives? We read stories because they are... there's something that doesn't usually happen, right? If we read something that usually happens, we call that a blog. We don't call that we don't call that a story. Literature is cathartic or interesting or enlightening or entertaining because it's unusual, because it's the kind of thing that doesn't normally happen. narrative is always about a specific sequence of events that happens in a specific point and time and place.
Right.
And Rabbi Zeira's statement essentially highlights that feature of this story. This is a one-time event. You can't rely on that happening all the time. So even if we were to say, yes, the story's coming to show that you have to get drunk to the point where you shecht your guest, and hey, whatever, Rabbi Zeira is saying, no, that can't be, because we can't rely on a nace happening all the time. This cannot be the rule. We have to consider this to be an exception. So this story, in many ways, is really a very, almost an archetypal contrast between law and narrative. Of course, when we think about it in these terms of law as being the rule and narrative as being the exception, right? And we realize that every maaseh in every time a breita or a mishnah brings up a maaseh, and I have a friend who wrote his thesis on exactly this issue, with a maasim in mishnah in Tanaitic literature, essentially every time it brings up a maaseh, we have this conflict between the norm and the exception. And it's a basic tension that exists within law. Every time you have a rule, well, does the rule account for this exception? Sometimes yes and sometimes no. When you think about how it functions in Tanakh, right, where do we have the most, right, the Chumash is made up of laws and narratives. Where does it come to a head? Where is the point of tension or the points of tension that stick out the most? Sorry?
Sorry, Isaac.
Okay, Akedas Yitzchak is a big one, yeah. But there the law is implicit, right? Avram assumes that it's usher, we assume that it's usher to kill, and God tells him to kill, right? It's more conflict between the law that God gives him at that moment and a sort of universal law that we assume to exist. Who comes forward and says, hey, let me be an exception, I should be an exception, the law shouldn't apply to me?
Benot
Slavchad, right? Benot Slavchad say, Lama ni garar, why should we be left out? Why should we be the exception? The law excludes us. And in the end, the law makes room for that exception. Right? Maase of the story, yes, but then the law comes to include that maase. Who else? Right, Pesach Sheni, right? The Tmeim come forward and they say, why should we be left out? Again, Lama Ni Gara, why should we be the exception? And again, the law makes an explicit exception. The exception becomes part of the law. So this is a very basic tension. Once you start paying attention to it, I already pay attention to it, you see it over and over and over and over and over again. In some ways, the tension between law and narrative is very much wrapped up in the entire holiday of Purim. Think about the Megillah. What goes on in the Megillah? What creates the basic tension within the narrative of the Megillah?
Haman.
And what does Haman do?
Causes us to make loads of noise.
Sorry?
Causes us to make loads of noise, which is exactly what we normally do.
Right? But what's the threat that Haman poses? What does Haman do when he wants to threaten the Jewish people?
He tries to destroy us.
How does he do that? He doesn't just... What?
He
makes a lot, and he decides on a date, and then
he
goes to Achashverosh, and he says, right? He gives him the money, and Achashverosh passes a law, and it's the law that Mordechai is threatened by, right? It's the fact that now it becomes the law in the kingdom that everybody has to kill the Jews on Gimel Adar. And laws keep popping up in the Megillah. Right? Every time you turn around, there is a law. In Perek Aleph, there's a law about how much you have to drink. Shtiyakadat einonis, right?
The law doesn't change.
Law doesn't change, and that's what scares Mordechai. The only way to change the law is to pass another law that doesn't explicitly contradict the first one, but ends up canceling it out. Right? Haman, when he wants to kill Mordechai, has to go to Achashverosh again and get him to sign a law that he can kill Mordechai. Everything is done, kedas ukedin, right? What was the other example I was about to say? Skips me. Anyway.
The women at the beginning, they write a law about...
They write a law, right? When Ahasuerus wants to stick it to Vashti, who is already beyond having anything stuck to her, he passes a law that all men should rule over their wives. Interestingly, who is the exception in the entire Megillah over and over and over again?
who's always the one singled out, the one who's the exception to every rule, the one who breaks the law and gets away with it?
Esther,
right? Esther is the one girl who's chosen. She's the one who doesn't bring anything with her to Achashverosh, and he's enamored with her. When she says to Mordechai, I can't go to the king, and he says, you have to go, she says, I'll break the law, and she gets away with it. She foils Haman's plot by singling him out, by making him the exception, the only one invited to the Mishteh, right? And then eventually she turns the tables on him by saying he's the one, Ishtar V'Oyev. Something to think about, right? It's very much wrapped up in the whole essence of the Megillah. And when Rabbi Zeira says, Lo b'chol shata v'shatam, it's rachish nisa, is there any better summing up of the entire Megillah, right? Here we are, the Jewish people, about to be slaughtered, and Hashem saves us. We can't rely on that kind of miracle happening all the time, right? But sometimes it happens. The Megillah is an exception. The Megillah is the exception that then, of course, becomes the law being the holiday of Purim, when at the end of the Megillah, Mordechai sends out the laws, and Purim is established. The tension between law and narrative, therefore, is very much a part of, an essential part of Purim, and that may be why this tension is so blatant in this particular Gemara, in this particular issue. What I want to do in the rest of the time is talk about how the Rishonim grapple with this Gemara, how they grapple with this tension. It's too obvious to ignore. It's too problematic to simply brush onto the rug. When the Rif quotes this Gemara, the Rif tellingly leaves out the Agada. Right? Now, the Rif leaves out lots of Agada. The Rif's job, ostensibly, is just bring the halacha parts of the Gemara. The Rif often brings agadot that he thinks are relevant to the halacha. This is not one of them. So by the Rif simply editing out the story, he has cast the die and said, you know what, very interesting story, right? Great Purim Torah, whatever it is, fascinating event, completely irrelevant to the halacha. The narrative has nothing to tell us about what the halacha is. And that bothers another Rishon, an early Rishon. If you look on the second page, I printed, for sake of saving paper and toner ink, I just printed a page from the tour, which essentially has snippets from all of the Rishonim that I want to quote. If you look down at the Darkei Moshe, the Rama, who quotes... No, take it back. Look up at the Beis Yosef. Third line down. No. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 lines down in the paragraph. That's the last word in line is V'chatav. V'chatav Haran. It's right after the Aleph in parentheses. V'chatav Haran b'shem Rabbi Beinu Ephraim. Rabbi Beinu Ephraim is an early Provençal Rishon. D'me'ahu uvda d'kam rabba b'su'udata b'su'udas purim b'shachtel or b'zeira k'di'it b'gemara id chilei meimra d'rava v'lo shapur dami l'meivad hachi. Says Rabbi Beinu Ephraim, from the fact the Gemara includes the story, what is the Gemara's message? Very nice, Rava, you had an interesting halacha. The Gemara is rejecting, implicitly rejecting Rava's halacha. Shocking. When we try to resolve halacha and agada, right, which we do 99% of the time, I don't know of any instance where the Maisa actually undermines the halacha. Right? What's Rabbi Beinu Ephraim saying, essentially? This is simply too dangerous. It's too dangerous to do. We can't allow this kind of thing to happen. And that must be the Gemara's message, he says. So those are the two extremes. The Rif, on the one hand, completely ignores the story. He thinks that the story is not relevant at all to the halacha. Rabbeinu Ephraim says, no, the story is very relevant, so relevant that essentially the story is koveya the halacha. If we translate the story, which is a narrative, into legal terms, what would be the halacha that emerges from the story?
Don't
get drunk, right? Rava says get drunk. According to the story, you can't get drunk. And if you think about the debates that go on nowadays about getting drunk on Purim, where you have lots of people who say, it's mitzvah to drink, and on the other hand, you have people saying... Statistically, we know that if people drink on Purim, there are going to be X number of car accidents, and all they knew, hopefully this year no one will be killed, but
statistically speaking, it's likely that there are going to be a serious number of casualties. That's the debate that's still going on. On the one hand, you have an argument from law. This is the law. You have to do it. It's binding. On the other hand, you have an argument from narrative. Look at what actually happens in specific events at specific moments in time. Translate that narrative into law, and you have undermined the law as it's formulated. This is the basic tension that we're always facing when it comes to law. Do we pay attention to the law, and the exceptions are unfortunate, tragic situations? Or to the unfortunate, tragic situations, do those exceptions, do the people who say lama nigara, does that somehow become the law, possibly undermining the first law as it's written?
Can you just define what the law is? Well, you're saying you can't understand
the law. The law is drink on Purim. The narratives are tragic events happen.
No, no, but drink on Purim, to what extent?
Drink on Purim until... Good. Drink on Purim, according to just following what the Gemara says, drink on Purim until you don't know the difference between Arham and Baruch Mordechai, which I think we could translate into a fairly high level of a fairly high blood alcohol level.
I mean, yes and no, that's what I'm getting at. We'll leave it at that.
Good. Okay. So Jonathan, the lawyer, is already saying... Is already saying, wait a minute, there's got to be a way out here, right? Every good lawyer knows when they go before the judge, they've got to have a more compelling argument than saying, hey, this law is just a bad law, right? That's not going to fly. That's the path Rabbeinu Ephraim takes. It's extreme, but it's striking that he takes it, and Rabbeinu Ephraim's argument continues to echo up to contemporary times, where, you know, Rabbi, who just left as head of the OU, Rabbi Weinreb, who has made this one of his crusades, will tell you, you cannot drink on Purim. It's usur, because if you do, right, some of the tragic things are going to happen. He doesn't make exceptions. He doesn't say, oh, well, the law should maybe apply this or mean that. No, don't drink. Don't drink. Right, Rabbi Twersky, I haven't heard him speak on this topic. I imagine that his approach is: look, there are alcoholics out there. If you encourage people to drink, you're getting kids hooked on liquor. And okay, but there's got to be another way. And all of these Rishonim try to find some middle ground, starting with Tosfos. V'chatua Tosfos, d'lo yada bein araham l'barach Mordechai, arura zeresh brucha Esther, arum kol rishon bruchan kol atzadikim. Okay. Why does Tosfos add that in? Why does Tosfos add all those things on? Gemara doesn't say all that. What's the point? V'chein katav haran. The run echoes Tosfos. Why? Kilomar. Di ben araham lebarach Mordechai l'chud afilu shata tuva lo taibe. Right? Says the run. If it were just between Haman and Mordechai, nobody is ever going to make that mistake. You would have to be so far gone to confuse Haman and Mordechai. So Tosfos throws a few more things in. You know what? You've got to confuse Haman and Mordechai and Esther and Zeresh, and by the time you get up to the other room and Tzadikim and you're a little bit drunk, you can't remember what they are. Done. Finished. Go. Put the liquor away. Right? Tosfos, by simply adding a couple more phrases to the Gemara, according to the Ran's interpretation, is trying to mitigate the impact of the Gemara. Right? By simply adding more words, by simply changing the form of the law, by simply adding a few more terms in. Take a look at the Mahariv, who quotes the Rambam, or says something similar to the Rambam, third line down in the Darkei Moshe. Umhariv katav derot zalomar shiishtaker v'yishan v'lo yada bein araham l'barach Mordechai b'chein mash b'maimoni. The Rambam says explicitly, and this is a very strange passage in the Rambam. I shouldn't say strange. The Rambam says, you have to get drunk until you fall asleep. And he leaves it at that. Why fall asleep? Because then you don't know. I would venture to say pshat in the Rambam is that the Rambam is simply reading the Gemara and saying, well, when don't you know the difference between Aharon and Baruch Mordechai? When you fall asleep. Okay. The Rambam also is mitigating the impact of the Gemara. You don't have to be so far gone to fall asleep at the table. Okay. I heard a parish once, and I would love for somebody to find it for me again, that ties that Rambam in with the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, where he says that all of the Nisim in Tanakh were really dreams, right? So if Rabbah brought Rabbi Zera back to life, It must have been a dream. So Pshat in the Gemara is that Rabba fell asleep. And that's how he reached out. Maybe. Again, I don't remember where I saw that or who told that to me, but it's an interesting Pshat in the Rambam. What's fascinating about that Rambam is that the Beis Yosef doesn't quote the Rambam. That's very unusual that the Beis Yosef leaves the Rambam out of all the Rishonim that he quotes. He just leaves the Rambam out here, and the Shulchan Aruch does not bring down the Rambam. It's the Ramah who, after he quotes this Rambam, who actually brings the Rambam down here. The Shulchan Aruch simply quotes the Gemara, as does the Tur. Another Perush, right? V'amin hagim kadvu de piut echad haya, continuing on in the base, in the Darkei Moshe there, shehayu onim al bayit echad aror haman ve'al bayit echad baruch mordechai. V'tzerach tzidut ha-shelo yata lefamin, right? He says, "What pshan arham baruch mordechai?" There's this piyut where on one stanza they say arham, and the next stanza they say baruch mordechai. So everybody messes up so often. So you just have to be drunk enough that you mess up every so often. That's what it means, right? He takes the words arham baruch mordechai, puts it in the context of this piyut, and okay, so you don't have to be so drunk. The most ingenious Peirush, which is brought down by the Magen Avraham, is the Aguda, who was an early 14th century German Rishon, who told us Adam V'chava Nesiviyot, the Rabbeinu Yerucham, Katav, D'cheshbon, this is the beginning of Darkei Moshe, D'cheshbon Oroham Nebarach Mordechai Shaveh, V'tzarech Lishtaker Ad Lo Yada HaCheshbon. What does that mean? The gematria of Orohaman and the gematria of Baruch Mordechai are equivalent. So what is the same shot is, then Adlo Yad Ben Aram Baruch Mordechai, you have to be so drunk that you can't do the math. What are all of them doing? They're somehow harnessing something in the form of the law, right? The law is formulated in a certain way. They're picking up on nuances in the law. Did Rava mean any of these things? Did Rava have this piyut in mind? Unlikely, it would be highly anachronistic. Did he have in mind this gematria? Maybe, but Pshat, I doubt it. All of these Rishonim are harnessing something in Pshat in the Gemara, in Pshat in the law, or sorry, not Pshat, in the text of the law, in the form of the law, as a way to somehow mitigate the tension between the law and the Agada, and say that even though the Agada seems to be completely undermining the law, we can interpret the law in such a way as to make the Agada and the Halacha closer to one another, to be not in such conflict. Okay.
I joined the ranks of those 40 and above this week.
Welcome.
Yes, I was told by many a friend that the Mishnah Nava says Ben Arbaim Labina, you become 40, the Bina comes. Give me a minute, it'll be here. Anyway, there it is. No Zohar. Although my mother and father mentioned that a couple of times now. You're 40, you can learn Zohar. I said, yeah, Mom, if we were Polish and living in Poland, then I would be beyond the scope of the harem that was enacted in Poland. But since that's not the case, I can learn, even when I was 39, I could have learned Zohar. In any case, I'm going to try, probably in many ways I'm going to be connecting the two shirim that came previously into a bit of a coherent idea, an overlook of the Megillah itself, in order to get to a certain, as they say in English, Nekuda, in Yeshivisha English, and to a certain point, which is really a vein that goes through the entire Megillah. You know, when you look at the whole story of the Megillah, things are just not clear at all. I mean, we know that we read the Megillah for the purpose of Pirsumei Misnisa, right? Those of us that have learned the Gemara and Megillah know the Gemara goes on for about a whole page about what Pirsumei Nisa is. Does it push off Talmud Torah? Does it push off Avodat Beit HaMikdash? You know, is it so important that we do Pirsumei Nisa that it pushes off everything basically but Met Mitzvah? Fine. So we get to reading the Megillah, we're performing the Mitzvah of Pirsumei Nisa, and I have to tell you, I'm not quite sure what the Ness is that we're trying to publicize. I mean, what is it about the story of the Megillah that we want all the generations to know. On the one hand, we see that the story tells us that Bnei Yisrael apparently did something, and they're deserving of a punishment, which came in the form of Haman and his entire enactment about killing the Jews. And then miraculously we were saved. So the first question that comes to mind is, what did the Jews do? The Megillah doesn't exactly tell us in the story that they did something bad. It's not like it said by, for example, the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua, by chapter 7, it says by Achan, right? Achan ben Zabdi, from the tribe of Yehuda, he was Oel Becherim, right? He took from the spoils of Yericho, even though the Hashem had said all the spoils of Yericho are consecrated, asur to touch anything. But he took. Okay, but there it goes on and it says that he sinned, and that Bnei Yisrael were all, you know, connected to his sin because of the concept of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazet. But it says they sinned. The Megillah doesn't say anything about Bnei Yisrael actually doing anything. So question A is, what was the Avera? What was the sin that Bnei Yisrael did which brought the entire story on? Question two is, well, back to question, the original question I asked, what is it we're going to be publicizing? Are we trying to say that, oh, somebody stood up, they wanted to kill us all, and therefore we're remembering this for generations because they didn't succeed? Well, I'm sorry, but we say it much more succinctly in the Haggadah. Shebechol dor vador omdim aleinu lechaloteinu v'ad HaKadosh Baruch Hu matzilenu mi'adam. I don't need an entire Megillah, which doesn't even say that quite clearly, in order to tell me that that's the issue. So what is it that we're going to publicize? Pirsuming is... I would quote Rav David Orlovsky here. He has these great one-liners. He says that, you know, if you really wanted to sum up all of Jewish history, you could sum it up in one sentence. They came, they tried to kill us, they didn't succeed, let's eat. That's that seems to be what we're doing. You know, they came, let's eat. But that's not only by Purim, that's almost by every single holiday. So, okay, let's eat. You know, if we skip the Megillah, let's just get to the food. So, that really is the issue. That really is the issue that's going on in the background. However, in addition to that, there's a couple more things. We say that the mitzvah sayom, aside from Megillah, which is Pirsumei Nisa, is also Mishloach Manot Ish L'Re'eu. Okay. Why is that? Because they did it. Well, why did they do it? I don't know. We have a Matanos Levyonim. Matanos Levyonim is a little bit more clear, because the truth is that every holiday, basically, we have a mitzvah of Matanos Levyonim. But here, it's even extra special. It's not just Matanos Levyonim, right? You have to two Matanos to two Evyonim, right? That's the easiest way to remember this halacha. Mishloach Manot, right? Ish L'Re'eu. One person has to send to his friend two Manot. Manot is plural. V'matanot, plural. Two Matanot Le'Evyonim, plural. Two Anim. Okay, that's the easiest way to remember. Just remember the pasuk. You know the halacha concerning these things. But why in the world do we have them in the first place? What is so special about Purim that there's a shaychas for these mitzvahs? Furthermore, we have that great part of the Gemara which Reb Daniel was just talking about, that Rava comes along and he tells us, Chayav inish levesumei bepuraya adalo yada ben Baruch Mordechai va'aruhaman. I sometimes get it confused. Maybe I could be potter even without drinking. In any case, you know... Why? What does that have to do with the story of the Megillah? I mean, fine, we mentioned Haman, we mentioned Mordechai, wonderful. But why is it a chiyuv? Rava comes along and says, it's not just a good thing. It's not like a practical joke, one of the funny things you do on Purim. No, you have to do it. Chayav inish levesume. However, whatever the shir is, and we won't get into that. I will say this, there was a great story that I had when I was learning in Shalavim, that one year... It was a regular Purim. It wasn't one like an Erev Shabbos or something like that, or like Motzei Shabbos. No, regular Purim. We came out of Tanis Esther, and we read the Megillah, L'Berov Am, like they do in the yeshiva every year. And then one of the American boys stands up on one of the tables, pulls out a bottle of Jack Daniels, screams out, "Let the games begin!" and makes a tremendous shahakol, and drank about a third of the bottle. Okay, 45 minutes later, he was at one of the Ramim's house passing out on the floor. And as he was passing out on the floor, he was saying, Baruch Mordechai Aruhaman, Baruch Mordechai Aruhaman, you can't take me, Ben Zev. Okay, well, he wasn't going anywhere, so I decided I was going to take him. I can't remember if I was before the army, after the army, I took him, schlepped him army style on my shoulders back to the dorm room. You know, he threw up a couple of times on the way, you go, lean to the side, try and avoid as much as you can. Anyway, so as Reb Daniel mentioned in the name of Tosfos, right, there's a lot more reason to add on a couple of words there, because he was well in his cups, and he was still saying, Baruch Mordechai Aruaman. Anyway, but why in the world do we have that? Why is this one of the halachas of the Suda on Purim that a person has to drink that certain amount? And lastly, one of the famous clinchers that comes to Purim is that we say, Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudi maleim, which the Gemara says, Shabbos Daf Beitet says quite famously, you know, Kimu masha kiblu kvar, they accepted what they already received in the past, right? Meaning that they accepted the Torah mi'ahava by Purim, and Rashi says mi'ahavat ha-nes. What is this great love that they had? Love of the nes that occurred, and that's why they re-accepted the Torah. But here they did it as opposed to Har Sinai, where they did it b'tfia. Here they did it be'ahava. Okay, so what was it that happened here? I mean, you know, you can think of many times where we have a similar Megillah going on in the newspapers, right? Lechora, the politicians are getting on our case, and all of a sudden there's some Yeshua, right? Lezareinu, it doesn't happen all the time, but many times it happens, and you don't see us, all this Ahavat HaNes coming out, which would tell us that, oh wow, now I'm accepting the Torah Be'ahava right now. Okay, so what is going on here? That's how I'm going to sum up all of the questions. What is Purim all about? So, I think we'll start at the beginning. Okay, we'll start at the beginning. And the beginning, in my opinion, is to answer the first question that we asked. What was it that the Jews did that brought everything about? So there's a Gemara in Megillah on Daf Yud Bet Amud Aleph, which deals with this issue. It's a very interesting Gemara. It's a one-of-a-kind Gemara. Okay, I'm going to read it out to you, and we'll translate it as we go along. Right, the Gemara says the following. Shalu Talmidav et Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Right, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was in the Beit HaMidrash. His Talmidim come up to him, and they say, Rebbe, we got a question. What's the question? Why were the Jews, right, Soneim Shel Yisrael is a catchphrase which Chazal used. They don't want to say that, you know, all of the Jews, right, Ganz Yehuda, they don't want to say that all of the Jews were, you know, deserving of death. So they say, those terrible people, Soneim Shel Yisrael, those people that hate Am Yisrael, right, they're referring to all the Jews now, right? Why were all the Jews supposed to be killed? What did they do that was so bad? Amar Lahem, so he gives them the following very Jewish answer, Imru Atem, you tell me, right? Answer a question with a question, which is a little weird, right? This is the only time, to my knowledge in Shas, that we find one of the Tanaim that answers his Talmidim that come and ask him a question, like, I have no idea, what do you think? Usually, they'll just go out and give an answer. So, fine, they have an answer. They said, Amrulo mifnei shenehenu misudato shel oto rasha. It must be because the Megillah tells us at the beginning of the Megillah that the Jews of Shushan were invited to come to the Masibah v'Chashverosh, and they enjoyed it. They had a great time, and that was so bad that they deserved to be destroyed. Fine. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, "I accept the premise, but let's check it out a little bit." Imken. You're talking to me about the Jews of Shushan. The Jews of Shushan went to the king's party. They enjoyed it. What about the rest of the Jews? The Jews were living in 127 Medinas, not just in Shushan. So why should they deserve to die? Okay, got me. Good point. I get it. So they said back to him, Emorata, okay, you got us, Rebbe. So what's the answer? He says, Amar lehem ifnei shishtachavu letzelen, says Rashi, b'yamei Nebuchadnezzar. Why were they deserving of destruction? Because in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the Jews bowed down to the idol which was discussed in Sefer Daniel. Amrulo, so they said back to him, v'chi masu panim yesh badavar. Right, Hashem kind of hides his face, which Rashi explains to me. Okay, if they did such a tremendous avera, then why did he get them out of it? Why weren't they destroyed? To which he says, Amar lahem, hem lo asu elu lefanim, af HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo asayim elu lefanim. The Jews, when they worshipped the Avodah Zarah of Nebuchadnezzar, they only did it outwardly. Inwardly, they said, this is a stupid thing, this is a stupid king, this is a stupid... You know, they were bowing down, but the bowing down was only on the outside, but not on the inside. So therefore, Hashem, Mida Keneged Mida, did to them, Lifanim, Meaning what? That the entire story of the Megillah was a scare tactic. Okay? Really, he says, Hashem did lefanim, Hashem was pulling a gag, ki'ilu. It's not that they really were going to be destroyed. The entire thing was to wake them up just a little bit, to scrape off that little bit of offense which they created at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, and become clean again. Okay? There's a difference of opinion here. It's a little bit deeper than this. The truth is, there's a very interesting Masorat HaShas on this Gemara. The Masorat HaShas on this Gemara points to a source in Shir HaShirim Rabbah. Okay, the Midrash. And interestingly enough, in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, we find that there's a machloket between Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and Chachamim, in which Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai basically says, word for word, what his Talmidim came up, the answer that his Talmidim came up with, and the Chachamim say what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai came up with here. Okay, but when Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was asked the question, well, if that's the case, if they enjoyed the Seuda of Ahasuerus, then why weren't the Jews of Shushan destroyed? Why everybody? To which Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said very simply, Kol Yisrael Aryavim, Zebazeh. If one Jew or a group of Jews were to do an Aveira, and Bnei Yisrael, knowing that, did not take any action against them in order to rectify the situation, so then yes, all of Bnei Yisrael are responsible for the sin of a few. Now, regardless of that, of which is the pshat, we have two entirely different pshatim here. Right? Either the issue is, like Rabbi Shimon, I'll take the position that we found in the Midrash because it's a lot more clear. Either the issue is that, like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, a real Aveira was committed here. That Bnei Yisrael, they go to Achashverosh's house, he throws a whole masuba. Why did he throw the whole masuba? The Gemara and Megillah tells us because 70 years had passed, according to the Cheshbon of Achashverosh. And basically that means that the entire Nevuah of Yirmiyah was wrong. And therefore, it's time to break out the party, because Bnei Yisrael, they're not going anywhere. Okay, they're here to stay. Come the Jews, and they take part in that party. Right? A party about their downfall. That's the party you're going to take part in. Okay, the truth is, they were forced to do it. But once they were there, the wine was good, the food was good, right? The couches were fine, everything was good. Everybody, you know, they were honoring them, they were respecting them, they got tax breaks, and it was great. And they started to enjoy themselves. Okay, now the Midrash says slightly different. It says because they ate bishuleg akum. Okay, really what went on is that what were they eating? They were eating non-Gosher food. Okay, and that was a serious Aveira. That's according to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, they were eating treifa food. They were eating non-Kosher food. According to the Chachamim, it wasn't really a sin. Outwardly, in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the people bowed down to an idol. But since inwardly they weren't doing it, right? This is the whole sugya in the Gemara in Sanhedrin about whether you bow down, if you do it me'ava v'chiba, or if you do it me'yira, you know, whether it's considered to be a mazara or not. They were certainly doing it me'yira, according to all opinions. If you do it out of fear, not of the idol, but of the guy that's going to blow your head off, if you don't do it, then you're not doing a mazara technically. So, therefore, according to that opinion, there really wasn't a big sin here, it was a blemish. And therefore, the entire mahalach that comes out was not a retribution, it was a cleansing process. Okay? That's two different lenses that Chazal give us to view the story of the Megillah. However, no matter how we look at it, I want to point out, it's relevant, but it's irrelevant. Why? Because the real story behind the Megillah is not only that. That's just a point which isn't there. It's not clear. Why deserve to suffer? But when you take a look at the vein that goes through the entire Megillah, we find something very, very interesting. So let's start getting on that. The story of the Megillah begins with the Mishteh of Achashverosh, really. Okay? The Mishteh of Achashverosh, right? First of all, he becomes king, right? It starts at V'hi b'mei Achashverosh, hu Achashverosh, ha-molech, mi'odu v'ad kush. That speaks about the beginning of his malchus. Achashverosh, he was not a king. Okay? I'm sure Reb Eli spoke about this before. He wasn't a king. He was a very wealthy man. The reason why he was wealthy, because, well, basically he started out life, if I'm not mistaken, as a stable boy. But he happened upon a treasure trove. A treasure trove that was hidden by Nebuchadnezzar in order that his children shouldn't get it. Why? Don't know the story. But Nebuchadnezzar put aside a tremendous sum of money, which Ahasuerus found, and he used that to amass even more wealth and become a phenomenally wealthy man. He became king not because he deserved it, but because he happened to be the wealthiest man there around in his time. So what happens? He becomes king. In order to make it a kosher malchus, he marries the granddaughter of the real king, of Nebuchadnezzar. He marries Vashti. And when eventually he makes it to the city of Shushan. Now the city of Shushan, you should know, I'm sure Rebelli also mentioned this, was a small Jewish outpost in the middle of nowhere. So why did it become the major city of Ahasuerus's Malchus? Well, because Ahasuerus coveted the throne of Shlomo HaMelech. Now Shlomo HaMelech, I'm sure you heard the Midrash, he had a fantastic throne. It was mechanical, it was even more than mechanical, you could even call it robotic. Basically, it had several levels. Each level there were, if I'm not mistaken, on each level there were lions, and if a person would approach who was not Shlomo, who was not of the Malchus, the lions would take a swipe at him. Okay, so Ahasuerus wanted to use the throne of Shlomo, but because he couldn't get close, because these lions kept trying to frighten him off, he decided he was going to make something similar. And he was going to do, it couldn't be the mechanical one just was against him, so he was going to make a replica. Now the problem was that the only artisans which could formulate such a thing happened to have come from Yerushalayim, and they were living in the city of Shushan. So he came up to them and he said, listen, I want you please to make me the throne, a replica of the throne of Shlomo. They go, they make it, it took them a couple of years, 3 years to be exact, and at the end of 3 years it was ready. The problem was it was so tremendous that they couldn't move it. Okay? So instead of being able to bring it back to the Ir Habira, which was in Damascus, if I'm not mistaken, maybe I'm confused. So he decided, well, if I can't move the chair and that's my throne, I'm going to make the Kisa Malchus in Shushan. So he started making a metropolitan city out of this tiny Jewish village in Shushan because that's where his throne was. So the city of Shushan goes up, a fantastic palace was created, it was one of the seven wonders of the world in their times, and that's the beginning of the story. Fine, after the city is built, he makes the Mishteh. Okay, the Mishteh, as we said, is because the 70 years, according to his calculations, have been up, right? Belshazzar made a mistake, this guy made a mistake, the other guy made a mistake, oh, I'm the right guy, right? My turn to bet, and I'm the right guy. It's kind of like if, you know, all the Rishonim, they make calculations in Sefer Daniel as to when the Mashiach is going to come. And if I'm not mistaken, Rashi even says in his parish on Daniel, he says something to the effect of, listen, you know, people have made mistaken explanations as to when the Mashiach is coming. Well, now it's my turn. And Rashi makes a parish which didn't come true. Anyway, that's just the way that Ahasuerus was as well. He made a parish, it wasn't true, but okay, the end of the world. So he makes the Mishnah. The Jews come for whatever reason. Right, not right, Mordechai was against it. They came anyway. All right, we'll skip that part. In the Mishteh, here he is, he's drinking. The Gemara tells us that really, when this king, he was not, you know, the finest of individuals. As we said, the Gemara says he was a stable hand. And he made the party, the Gemara says, in order to show off booty. And his wife, Vashti, she also made a party in order to show off booty. You know, that's what they were doing. It was not exactly one of these fancy English tea parties. Okay, it was more like a Roman orgy. And that's what was going on. Now, his intention was that. His wife's intention was that. The Gemara tells us that he got to an argument with his friends who had the most beautiful woman. And Ahasuerus says, well, I certainly do. And his friend said, well, you've got to better prove that to us, in which case he says, okay, no problem. So they say, well, if you want to prove that to us, you should come in front of us stark naked except for the crown. Now, Vashti wasn't against that idea, okay? She had intended, like we said, it was basically an orgy. And she was not against that idea. But for one reason or another, she got into her head that when Ahasuerus comes to tell her to do that, she's not coming. Okay, fine. So Ahasuerus gets very angry at him. He's under the influence, we all know. But we know the outcome is that he kills her. Now that was the stupidest thing that Ahasuerus could do. Because his only real claim to the throne, outside of being wealthy, was the fact that he was married to the king's granddaughter. Okay, so to get rid of her was a big, big mistake. But fine, anybody would have told him that. His real advisors would have told him that. But there was this one little advisor, the least of the advisors, who jumps to the front. He was, you know, his real advisors are about to speak. Mehuman, which our sages say is Haman, jumps to the front and he says, oh, I got the idea, kill her! And he goes, you know, that's a great idea, and he goes ahead and he does that. So, afterwards he regrets it. They start the search for the next queen, right? Now normally, A king would not go all out to search for the next king, next queen. He would go to the local kings, and he would say to them, listen, I'm a king, you got a princess, give me a princess. Ahasuerus didn't do that. He goes, he collects all the women from everywhere. Okay? The Gemara says that once he came out with the proclamation, we're taking all of the women, everybody ran to hide their daughters. You know, because who wants to, you know, he's going to have 50 million wives. Why should he take my daughter? So everybody was hiding their children in order to get away. Now, out of all of them, who does he pick? He picks to be his wife none other than Esther, which there's an opinion in Chazal who says she was 73 years old at the time, and she was green. Okay, she was not Esther Yerukreket Haita. Okay, so she was not a virgin. She was not a young woman. And she was green, okay? Those don't seem to be the signs of somebody you're going to pick to win the beauty pageant. But the Gemara tells us, the Megillah tells us, that when Esther walked into the hall, there was a chen that descended upon everybody. Oh, everybody wanted to help out Esther. Esther wanted nothing to do with it, okay? I remember growing up in America, the impression that I got, I don't know if it was the school or if it was what, but the impression is kind of like that Esther was the hands-down winner. Okay, she knew she didn't require anything special because she knew her beauty shined so far that she was going to win anyway. That's kind of the feeling that you get in a way when you read through the Megillah. But the truth is that she did everything in her ability that she wouldn't be chosen. Okay, she didn't take the jewelries, she didn't take the clothes, right? She only took what she had to, what she was forced upon her. She didn't want it, but he chose her anyway. Okay, let's go on a little bit further. Let's see. Okay, Haman comes to power. That's basically the next story. Haman comes now. Who was Haman? Haman, the Gemara tells us at a later point, was a barber. Okay, he started out his life, he was a barber. Some way or another, he became a general in Ahasuerus' army. Okay, now, his fellow general in Ahasuerus' army was a fellow named Mordechai. All right, Mordechai HaYehudi, to be precise. And they were generals which were sent to wage a war at a certain place. I don't recall what his name was. The Gemara tells us that Haman did not take care to watch out for his rations. Okay, he had parties, you know, he gave the men extra, and all of a sudden he found himself starving to death because he ran out of food, he ran out of water, ran out of whatever. So he turns to Mordechai and he says, Mordechai, I need your help. So Mordechai says, you need my help? Well, what am I supposed to do? I have rations for me, I need it for my men. Okay, you were stupid. You didn't listen. You didn't do things b'seichel. So now you have your own problem. So Haman begs him and begs him and begs him until Mordechai finally says, you know what? I'll give you food on one condition. You sell yourself to me as an eved. Okay? So they had nothing to write on. So Mordechai takes off his sandal and they etch into his sandal the bill of sale. Okay, now this was not something which was not known. This was something that was known. So not only did Haman start out life in the lowly position of the local barber, but now he is upgraded to slave. Now, that slave, for one reason or another, becomes the highest vazir in the kingdom of Ahasuerus, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. You know, how is somebody who started out as a barber and became a slave, how does he become the highest advisor to the king? Doesn't make any sense. Okay, fine. He's so beloved by the king that the king enacts Xera that anybody that sees Haman should bow down to him. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Now, in my opinion, there's a little bit of modern historical resonance in this, if you recall that Ehud Barak, when he was prime minister a few years ago, so he was, I don't know, I would say a hands-down, really lousy prime minister, which was why he was chased out of the government. But for some reason or another, he's back in the government again, and he's already climbing to the top positions. Go figure. Okay, it's reminiscent. I don't understand it, but who knows? Anyway, back to the story. So here we have Haman climbs to a position of power, for whatever reason. He sees his former master, Mordechai, and he just can't take it. His former master, who was his master, who's walking around with a bill of sale on his shoe, and whenever Haman walks by, he not only doesn't not bow down to him, he picks up his shoe in order to show Haman that he has the bill of sale. Okay, so Haman gets so angry at Mordechai that he decides, I'm killing all the Jewish people. Hello? You're angry at Mordechai, you're going to kill all the Jewish people? How did you get from one to the other? Doesn't make any sense. Nope. Let's continue on. Mordechai hears the Gzeira, and he comes up to Esther, And he tells Esther, listen, you got to go do something. Right? The Jews, next year at this time, are going to be killed. Well, actually, it was a little bit later. Next year are going to be killed. Right? The Chazal say that the entire story, the main story of the Megillah, occurred in the month of Nisan. Okay? But it was the year before the Jews were supposed to be killed. In other words, Haman made the Pur in Adar, and they made the enactment for the following year that that's when the Jews would be destroyed. So people basically had an entire year to prepare for the destruction of the Jews. Okay? As opposed to, I recently did a course in the Yad Vashem about the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. And the entire focus of Yad Vashem nowadays is basically to prove to you that really the Nazis didn't know what they were doing with the Jews from the time that Hitler came to power until basically the beginning of the 1940s. Okay, you go to Yad Vashem, they will prove to you, Be'otot u'moftim, that that was what was going on. I asked a simple question though, that the one of the professors there, I said, listen, you know, you said it, you brought rayas to it, I agree with it. But basically, there's one big problem in the way you're presenting it, is that when Hitler came to power, it's not that he didn't know what he wanted to do with the Jews. He always knew what he wanted to do with the Jews. Right? That's quite clear to anybody that read Mein Kampf. However, he just didn't know how he was going to go about getting to that end result. Here, Haman apparently knew quite clearly how to get to the end result. He just wanted people to take the time they needed in order to get ready to do it. Okay? So as opposed to Hitler, yamach shmo, Haman was quite clear with his plan, how to do it, when to do it, get ready. That was his plan. So we go on. Esther goes, after a short time of convincing from Mordechai, she goes, she fasts for 3 days. Now I know that me at the end of a day of fasting, I know exactly what I feel and what I look like. After 3 days, to this 72-year-old woman, who was green, you can imagine her taking on a shade more like this bottle. Okay? She was wobbly, she was not very effective, but she's coming to the king, Asher lo kedat. Okay, that the Megillah is very specific in telling us, Asher lo kedat. Right? It's not according to the proper means. But she does it. And Ahasuerus sees her, and his first instinct, for whatever reason, is he's going to kill her, but Anes occurs, he sticks out the Sharvit, which Chazal say stretches a few amot in order to reach to her, and she comes and she invites him to a mishteh. Okay? Who else comes to the mishteh? Ahasuerus and Haman. Okay, buddy, buddy, they're doing really good. You know, things seem to be fantastic. They have the mishteh. Esther tells Ahasuerus, tomorrow I'm going to tell you what you've always been wanting to know, right, what my nation is, and we cut to the next scene. Okay, Haman gets home to Vashti, his wife. He says, listen, this Mordechai, I can't stand him. Whenever I see him, my veins pop out, my blood pressure, you know, just going meshuga. I have to do something about this Mordechai. So she tells him, no problem, you make a tree, 50 amas, and you hang him from it. Now, where does he get the tree? Chazal tell us that in order to get the tree, it wasn't that they had lumber yards necessarily that were open at 2 in the morning, okay, which is when he was speaking to Zeresh. So what does he do? He says, okay, no problem. He breaks his house, breaks open his house, takes the main support beams from the second story of his house, and he uses them in order to make the gallows for Mordechai. Okay? Now cut to the next scene. Be'laila ha'hu nadada shnat ha'melech. All of a sudden, what? You got me. Right, the Chazal say that tzina mekalkelet the shurim. Right, somebody who hates, somebody who's angry at somebody else, it makes them think not straight. Okay, so that's my only etza. We don't know. Fine, the king has his dream. Right, he has some bad dreams. He can't sleep. He calls somebody in order to bring the Sefer Zichronot. They read the Sefer Zichronot. All of a sudden, Haman comes, and he's told instead of hanging Mordechai, he's now going to walk him through the streets. And not only is he going to walk up the street, he's going to say, "Kacha yaseh le'ish asher melech hafetz bikaro." Right? All of a sudden, he's going from the highest of the high to the lowest of the low. Right? Our sages tell us that on his way to being low, he walked by his house. He yells, "Kacha yaseh le'ish asher melech hafetz bikaro." And his daughter, who was on the roof, thought that that was Mordechai. She takes the local, what do they call it, chamber pot, and tosses it on his head. At which point, Haman looks up, His daughter sees that it's actually her father, and she jumps from the roof in shame. Okay, so that's why the Megillah says that he came to his house avel, right? He was an avelus because his daughter died, vechafui rosh, and his head was covered because he was covered with the chamber pot's contents. Okay, from this, he's immediately escorted into the second day party with Ahasuerus and Esther, at which point he's basically taken and hung. And we're all looking at this and we're following, and it's like, what is going on here? I don't understand. It doesn't make sense from the beginning to the end. Now, if you want my opinion, we continue on into the fact of Venahafohu, right? That the entire intention of what was intended to do with the Jews, that's what happened to the non-Jews. And not only did it happen to the non-Jews, but Rabim Me'amei Aretz B'Yadim, right? Not only that, but the non-Jews became Jews. They was, you know, things became so topsy-turvy that the non-Jews decided that it was time to become Jews. Rabbi Isaac, I think that the main issue of the Megillah was that if you would follow the events, there is nothing there that you could put your finger on that makes any sense. In other words, it's not like nowadays. We have our political clout, right? We have our political advisors. Everybody has their opinion, and they read the newspapers, and we're so convinced that I know what the course of action is. Well, it seems that if you follow closely what's accounted in the Megillah, and you would ask the Jews at any one point in time, what is supposed to be done now, they would say, I haven't got a clue. Yesterday we were Ahasuerus' friend. Today he wants to kill us. The next day he decides, no, you're my good friends again. You know, nobody knows how to deal with what's going on in the entire story. What is the Pirsumei Nisa of the Megillah? The Pirsumei Nisa of the Megillah is that when events occur which you have no way of understanding, you have no way of understanding, you cannot follow, you cannot piece together how these things happened because they make absolutely no sense, there is one conclusion that you have to come to, and that is that the Ribono Shel Olam is running the show here. Okay, because if it wasn't the Ribono Shel Olam, if it was following human logic progresses from one thing to the next. Okay, Haman, the proper course of action for Haman is not that he goes from barber to Eved to the Grand Vizier, right? The proper course for Haman would be that he first joins the local political party, and then he slowly works his way up the ranks, and eventually when he's 150, he makes it to the Grand Vizier position. That would make sense, okay? It would make sense if you want to tell me that Ahasuerus was absolutely consistent in the way that he lived his life. You know, if he's always party hardy and his wife is party hardy and they married together, it seems to be a shidduch b'shamayim. You know, all of a sudden Vashti, for whatever reason, she says, Ahasuerus, you oaf, I'm not doing what you say. And he kills her. It just doesn't make sense. When we take a look at our lives, we think that we understand what's going on. And the true issue is that we haven't got a clue. The Pirsumei Nisa of the Megillah is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the show. And the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to understand that is by paying close attention to what went on in the Megillah. It's not what's happening today. Okay, many times today there are things that happen we don't understand. But in perspective, we can put them in perspective. Right? We take a look back, we can put things in perspective. The Megillah, you can't in any perspective. Nothing in the Megillah makes any sense whatsoever. So it's Davka the Megillah, the story of the Megillah, none of which makes sense, which we're going to read every year, and we're going to learn about it every year, and we're going to discuss it every year, because from the very fact that none of the story makes sense whatsoever, we understand that Hashem is running the show. It's because of that reason that an integral part of the Seuda, right? We say, why do we have a Seuda? Because the Jews in those times made Yemei Mishteh V'Simcha. Why did they make Yemei Mishteh V'Simcha? Rashi tells us that because the entire Ness was performed, the crux of the Ness was performed by means of the Mishteh V'Simcha. Okay, it was those two little wine parties of Esther. It was that one big wine party of Ahasuerus. That's what made the story of Purim into what it was. And therefore, since the resonance of the wine party has something to do with it, we're going to have a party, we're going to have it with wine, but we're going to drink Ad Shelo Neda Ben Baruch Mordechai La'ar Haman. Because nothing makes sense. Okay? The point of drinking until you don't know the difference is because I don't understand. It doesn't make sense. The issue of mishloach manot ish l're'eu is because, basically, the Gemara tells us, if you have two people that are dirt poor, they can only afford to make a seudah for themselves. How are they mekayim the mitzvah of seudat purim, of mishloach manot? Well, very simple. This ani gives this ani his food, this ani gives this ani his food. They trade. Your food is my food, mine food is your food, because it doesn't matter, it doesn't make sense. Okay? Matanos le'evyonim, we have a special din of matanos le'evyonim, but matanos le'evyonim on Purim is kol man depashit yadei. Whoever sticks out their hand, on Purim you're supposed to give them something. Right? I always say jokingly, it says kol man depashit yadei noknim lo. It doesn't say what you give them. So many times a guy will come up to you and goes like this, I go, shkoyach. Doesn't say what you give them, then I give him something. Anyway, but, you know, why? Because it doesn't matter who you give it to, because it doesn't make sense. We don't know if this guy is rich, if this guy is poor. We're not supposed to take a look to know who he is, because the whole story doesn't make sense, because the Ribbono Shel Olam runs the story. The Ribbono Shel Olam, he's the one that makes sense of it all. The Ribbono Shel Olam, he's the one that knows how each thing is going to lead the other, and how each thing is eventually going to become for our betterment. Now, that's the story of the Megillah as a whole. Now, one more thing I forgot to mention is, why was it that the Jews, Davka, at this point in time, Kimu v'kiblu ayehudim aleim, right, which Rashi says, kiblu mashakiblu, kimu mashakiblu kvar, the Gemara says, they kept what they already received. Why did they take upon themselves a renewed commitment to Torah and mitzvahs after the story of the Megillah? Because nothing made sense, and it was clear that Hashem has everything in their best interests. Hashem is running the show, I don't understand it, but Hashem is doing it latovati. That's the story of the Megillah in a nutshell. But I think that there's a personal vein that we can all take with us, right? This is supposed to be a bit of a Musar Shmuz. The personal vein is that I discovered something the other day. I was sitting there and I was, you know, going through the motions of davening, and then I realized, hey, I'm actually speaking to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And here I am, I'm saying, Slach lanu avinu ki chatanu, mechal lanu malkeinu ki bashanu. I'm asking, Barech aleinu, et hashana hazot, et kol minei tevuotanu tova. I'm asking, right, Atachonen ladam dat, umelamed lenosh bina. I'm asking the Ribbono Shel Olam for all sorts of things, but so many times we're so rushed in doing what I think I need to do that we don't pay attention that right now I'm speaking to the one who has something to do with what I really need to do. Many ways, I happen to be my own worst enemy. Right, this reminds me of a pasuk. There's a pasuk in Kohelet. I wrote it down just to make sure that I remembered it. The pasuk in Kohelet says the following. Right, it's a Perek Zayin pasuk of Tet. Levad re'ezem matzati, asher asah Elohim et ha'adam yashar v'hema bikshu cheshbonot rabim. Right, God made men straight, but they ask all sorts of kakamamic questions. Right, we'll translate it a little bit off, right? Hashem made us straight, and we bend ourselves out of shape because we're always looking for the different ways that we can use it, the different ways that we can utilize it. Why? Because I'm my own worst enemy. If I were truly looking out for my own best interest, I would forget about me, and I would forget about my wants, and I would turn to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and I would say, listen, God, I've got it good. I'm here with you. That's really what's going on. There's a very lemaisadik side to this as well. You know, I recently had the opportunity to be part of what's called a 12-step group. Okay, for the recovering of addictions. Alcoholics, sexaholics, foodaholics, any other alcoholics that you know of. This entire program of whatever anonymous, if you've ever learned their stuff, it's all based on one principle, that a person has a tendency to become attached to something which he finds pleasurable, whether it be drink, whether it be sex, whether it be drugs, whether it be whatever. He attaches himself to that thing because it gives him some sort of escape from the problems of his life. But why does he have problems in his life? Well, basically because he thinks that he's like Atlas and he can carry the weight of the world. But really what he needs to do, this is the main crux of the entire program, whatever program a person would check it, their main crux is that it's not your problem, it's the Ribbono Shel Olam's problem. Okay, he has your best intentions in mind. He wants you to do well. You know, the Chafetz Chaim said that there's a mashal, there's a poor man that was walking along the road once upon a time, and he had this tremendous bag on his back. And he's walking along and he's schlepping, and all of a sudden a wagon pulls up alongside of him. And the guy says, listen, you know, I'm going basically the same direction as you are. Why don't you hop in? So the guy hops in. And he's sitting in the back and he's keeping his big parcel on his back. And the wagon driver looks at him and he says, listen, you know, the wagon, it's carrying you and it's carrying your bag. Why don't you put it down? He says, no, I don't want to bother you. So the Chafetz Chaim says, this is referring to a pasuk in Tehillim, which unfortunately just now escapes me, that basically the pasuk says that shlach al yahavcha et yahavcha al Hashem v'hu yakalkalecha, that a person has to throw down his sack onto Hashem and he will sustain you, he'll help you get by. Really, that's what's going on in life, is that most of the problems, most of the frustrations, most of the difficulties that we have in life, my biggest obstacle when it comes to them is me. Okay, because instead of saying the Ribono Shel Olam, okay, not talking about not doing hishtadlus, everybody has to do the hishtadlus, but at the end of the day, after the hishtadlus is done, it's not your problem. The rest of it is not your problem. A person thinks to himself, right, all of the difficulties, he has children, they need education, he has this, you know, we have to deal with this problem and that problem. You've done your hishtadlus, it's no longer your problem. Leave it up to Hashem. Hashem will help you. We are our own worst enemy. So really, if we're going to take something with us from the Megillah, which is all about the pirsum of the Ness which was that out of the entire quagmire that was the story of the Megillah, we see that Hashem runs the world, and we see it more clearly than we ever could have if things flowed in a very clear manner. So we have to take for ourselves that, Ribono Shel Olam, let me stop being my worst enemy. Let me finally take the me, right? Take the ani, put him aside, and in his place take anochi, which is Lashon Anava. Okay? I'm here for you, Ribono Shel Olam. Okay? You want me to do X, I'm going to do it. But the rest is up to you. And then we have to ask ourselves, Ribono Shel Olam, if you're the Noten Le'ayv Koach, so please give me the kochot that we need as a person, as an individual, as a nation, in order to come through these trying times and come out much stronger after the fact, because of the problems, in spite of the difficulties, because I now have forged a closer relationship with you, because I happen to have been in the way up until now. So, Yitzhak Hashem, this Purim, whichever shita you're going to pick in order to be mevesume ad loyada, but the aspect of drinking, it's there because the Ribono Shel Olam runs the world. And if you don't know the difference between Baruch Mordechai and Aruch Haman, that's fine, because Hashem is running the show anyway. It's not up to you, it's up to Him. So, Yitzhak Hashem, we should see lots of Yeshuas this Purim. We should come out strengthened, we should come out cleansed, and we should come out with a closer relation to the Ribono Shel Olam.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We'll celebrate for us together.